Thanks. Hold your applause. Hopefully I don't bore you to death so you find this interesting. For some of you in the back, I'm kind of soft-spoken, so you might want to consider moving up at some point. If you can't hear me, let me know. I'll try to speak up, but obviously it's a little warm in here, so we got the door open, so there's a little problem there. So today, basically, kind of the approach that I'm going to take here is just kind of share a little bit of information that's kind of wide-ranging about case style manners and what I've learned and kind of gathered in the last 4 years or so. Before I started my master's project, I'd been in two caves in my entire life. And they were commercial caves, and you know, this was, you know, with a handheld flashlight getting shown around, so didn't really have any experience. Initially for my master's, I had started off on a project on tiger salamanders. We were going to do some radio telemetry. The ultimate goal was to try to track down some populations of gopher frogs in Middle Tennessee. Some of you might be familiar with that, know there's only two records of that species. But the problem was, my first semester we caught a total of six tiger salamanders. They were all too small to put radio transmitters in, so I had to abandon ship on that project and was kind of in the, oh shit, what do I do face? So some of you guys who are master students or thinking about starting up a project, you can probably know the kind of pressure you're under to try to come up with a good idea. Fortunately, Brian Miller, he got a grant through TWRA. They were going to do a follow-up survey on the status and distribution of the Tennessee cave salamander. Initially, I wasn't too optimistic because what had been known about them before our project was that there's only about 13 localities in the state. Most populations supposedly were pretty small. They're really hard to find, tough to work with. So, you know, since I had just had trouble finding tiger salamanders, which I'm from Indiana, so they're real common to find in little cattle ponds up there, I was like, well, what's going on here? You know, I was a little down on my luck, but everything worked out for the best. So I'm here today because of this work. Essentially. But kind of the approach, initially the first half of class, I guess, I'll talk about the Tennessee cave salamander, cave salamanders in general, kind of their ecology, a little bit on genetics. Don't freak out too much. I'm not going to dive into too much detail. Then the second half, I'll talk briefly about some other species of salamanders you can find in cave and some of the caves and some of the cool observations that we've made in the last couple of years. So let's see if I can figure out to use this pointer. Too fast. Okay. So, I don't know how much knowledge you guys have about cave organisms in general, but kind of the public consensus is that it's usually an evolutionary dead end. You think of like a cave organism, you think of something that's maybe rather small, albino, blind. You know, obviously it was on the surface, it wouldn't survive at all. But actually there's a whole array of organisms that can be found in caves, ranging from, of course, vertebrates all the way down to the little invertebrates. But they range in their phenotypes and their abilities. So some are going to be just transient visitors that might be accidentally washed into a cave, might accidentally wander into a cave. If they can make their way back out, then they're going to survive. If they don't, usually the accidentals don't have any adaptations to exploiting resources within caves, so they're going to perish. So this is where we get a lot of our basically large vertebrate fossils are from cave deposits, where you might have, you know, a ground sloth or a pig or something like that that wanders into a cave, can't make its way back out, it dies, those bones are preserved because of that. Others, you know, might exploit a cave, you know, for reproduction, like zigzag salamanders. So like this time of year, they're really service active, but come summertime when it starts to dry out, they're going to move underground, oviposit, you know, nest there, and then come winter again or in fall, if we ever get some rainfall around here, they move back up to the surface. They're known as like a troglozine, so I'll kind of go over the classification. It's kind of a general classification scheme. There's a lot of debate about it, what exactly is a troglobi versus a troglophile versus a troglozine. Accidentals, pretty easy. You know, this is an organism that's not going to survive, it's just going to fall in. You know, it's there purely by accident. Troglozine, those are organisms that might hang out by caves, so they can exploit some of the cave resources, but they can't complete their life cycle within the cave. Okay, so at some point they have to go back to the surface. So you can think of bats, okay, a good example of the troglozine. Obviously they're going to use caves for roosting, raise their young, things like that, but they have to leave the cave in order to acquire prey, in order to eat. Troglophiles, then, these are going to be species that can live both within a cave environment as well as outside a cave environment and be able to complete their life cycle in both places. Many salamander species are troglophiles. Probably the best example around here is the spring salamander, where you can find subterranean populations You know, they're going to lay their eggs underground. Larvae can develop within the cave stream. They can undergo metamorphosis, and in some cases, adults can sustain themselves underground. Talk a little bit more about that later. And then the most specialized then is a troglobite. So a troglobite then is going to be an organism that can only live within the cave environment. If you transplant a troglobite to a pigeon or surface dwelling environment, they're going to perish. Okay, so they have specific adaptations that allow them to survive within the cave environment. kind of three things that all cave organisms are limited by, though, is obviously the darkness. So if you're a visually oriented predator, you're going to be in trouble if you go into a cave, right? Complete absence of light. So you have to have other adaptations that allow you to acquire food. Other problem is usually the scarcity of food. Unlike most surface environments, which are driven by the plant biomass, typically most cave environments, since there's no light, are not going to have any plants to drive the local food web. Okay, they rely on all the resources coming directly from the surface. That being like sinkholes, it might be an inflowing stream, or just water percolating in, so where there's a biofilm, things like that, or it might be driven by certain types of bacteria in extreme cases. Around here, the caves that we have within Middle Tennessee, most are driven by sinkholes, inflowing streams, things like that, that wash in organic debris, detritus, things like that, which can then drive the invertebrate food base, which can then support your secondary and tertiary consumers. That being said, though, obviously a cave food web is going to be quite a bit simpler than a surface dwelling food web or surface food web. And cave vertebrates, in particular, are also going to be limited by dimensions of the cavities. Now, what we call a cave is kind of a human term. It's not going to be the same thing as a cave to a salamander. Obviously, they can go through small, you know, very small crevices, things like that. Zigzag salamanders, you might find them in the middle of your yard. My old advisor, he's basically got plywood cover board set up in the middle of his lawn, you know, nice fescue all around it. But during this time of year, he can flip that board. There'll be tiny holes where the dorsalis will, zigzag salamanders will come up. You know, they might come out and forage, but then they'll migrate down in those holes and then make their way down to whatever subterranean passages are below his property. So they have the ability to kind of exploit this area. It's known as epikarst. Other species aren't going to do that. Those that are usually associated with streams, they're going to follow streams that might be washed in initially, or they might follow a spring. So if you go around springs, you know, certain salamanders like red salamanders, two-line salamanders, long-tail spring salamanders, maybe even dusky salamanders, you might find them a decent way into a cave, maybe in the twilight zone, maybe just past the twilight zone. Some species might even migrate even further back. So when we talk about troglobitic salamanders, then it's kind of a rare group. Really only two families, the Plethodontidae and the Proteidae, are troglobitic. There's roughly about 9 species, depending on what you want to call a species, down on the Edwards Plateau with all the Texas Eurasia still being worked out. 8 of those are in North America. The European Ulm is the only one found outside of North America and Europe. And all but 2 are pedomorphic. And by pedomorphic, I mean salamanders that are retaining those larval characteristics and reaching basically sexual maturity in that larval state. So they're going to have gills, still have their lateralis system, things like that, a big tail fin. That being said, unlike some other cave vertebrates like the fishes, there's no symmetry between any of the troglobitic species. So essentially, a single cave is only going to have one species of troglobitic salamander. Let's see if I can figure this out. I think the battery's dead. No big deal. All right, so there's a few phenotypic characters that might, that usually are associated with cave-dwelling salamanders. This is, you know, mutually exclusive list. There's others mentioned, but not all are going to exhibit this as well. But essentially, when you think of a cave-adapted salamander, they usually have a reduction in eyes. They're going to have a reduction in the visual brain centers. Okay. Usually, you see a reduction in pigmentation. Particularly, the longer that you stay underground, usually mutations will develop, like albinism, things like that. Usually, also see a reduction in body size. From a physiological standpoint, you usually see reduction in metabolism, but usually a more efficient metabolism. Salamanders in general, you know, have the unique ability to go months without feeding. So they're kind of almost pre-adapted, so to speak, to a subterranean existence where food might only be coming once a year, maybe in the fall when you have big heavy rains washing in a lot of invertebrates and other debris. You also usually see a reduction in fecundity and also basically a delaying of metamorphosis or even complete loss of metamorphosis. Species that I work with, the Tennessee cave salamander, it's a facultative pedomorph, so it can actually still undergo metamorphosis, but in nature it's usually very, very rare. There's only been 4 documented cases of that in the lab that can be induced, though, by adding a little bit of thyroxin, and they'll do it right away. Behaviorally, then, you should see a reduction in response to light, reduction in aggression, and also aggregation. So usually cave organisms are going to be scattered throughout their environment. With that, there's also a lengthening or enlargement of some other morphological characters, like your chemo and mechanoreceptors, so you're going to rely on olfaction and vibration to detect prey. You're going to see, obviously, an increase then in the non-visual brain centers. You see an elongation of the limbs, they become attenuated. You also see usually a lengthening of the lifespan, increased fat storage, and also a lengthening of that larval period to the point where you stay within that state. So within the Texas Eurasia that's been studied there, you usually don't because they're so isolated. What we found though with Geranopholis, since they're a very, very young group, I'll talk about that in a little bit, they're actually very, very aggressive and seem to be territorial. So you usually find them under the same rock, 3-4 months apart. You might find the same large female or large male there. And they apparently scuffle quite a bit. We've had it happen on a couple of occasions where we've captured individuals. Basically, our process is we go around, we catch the salamanders, put them in bags. We then move into the next pool, and then our way back out of the cave is when we do all our processing. And we've had it happen a couple of times where we put individuals that we thought would get along because they're similar size and found one halfway down the gullet of the other. So they are cannibalistic. So we stopped doing that. We had to put them in separate bags, the larger individuals. So they are quite aggressive. And then I'll actually talk more about that in Pseudotriton as well. So this diagram here is just, probably look at it in the notes later on, just kind of giving an overview of what I just talked about. In this case, it's a cavefish, but essentially similar things, loss of pigmentation, loss of eyes, things like that, enlargement of some of the other characteristics. Talk a little bit about cave development. Around here, this is kind of a diagram from the Central Basin where it's much flatter, so you have a lot of water that percolates through the limestone cracks and crevices. Essentially, carbonic acid forms, okay, slowly over time, and then you basically it dissolves that limestone away. So most caves are going to be developed within limestone. There are a few sandstone caves, but the majority of cave life is going to be found in these limestone caves. So you can have water percolating through eventually to where it reaches the water table, and that's where you have most of your cave development. And I'm still debated about how fast cave passages can form. How many of you have actually been into a cave? So a few of you. Anyone been to Mammoth Cave and seen how large those passages are? So some of the passages there have been estimated maybe 10, 15 million years old, the oldest. Most caves around here or within middle Tennessee are probably on the order or active passages where streams are flowing through, maybe only a million years old. But that being said, they're usually multi-tiered along the plateau, so you can actually see where the water table used to be. And then as the local streams have dissected the plateau, you get a gradual lowering in that water table. So if you have a long period of stability in that water table, you can get large passages developing. If it drops fast, then you're going to have much smaller passages. It's kind of the notion or what we think is going on there. So briefly, this is just a map showing the major karst regions within the United States. Obviously, you can see in Tennessee, we're kind of riddled with that. Within middle Tennessee, on eastward into the Valley and Ridge where we're at. Also, there's a high concentration of karst or caves within the Ozarks. Here around Florida and the Florida limestone, so those are underwater right now. Then also out in Texas. And kind of where it's in red here is where the cave salamanders, or basically the troglobitic salamanders, are found. So down in Florida, you have Hadeotriton, or the Georgia blind salamander, along the Edwards Plateau, is where you have several of the Texas Eurasia. In the Ozarks, you have one of the more unusual troglobitic salamanders, the grotto salamander, Eurystheus spelaeus, where it actually kind of does the reverse thing. It actually lives outside the cave, primarily as a larval form, then the larvae move in, they go through metamorphosis, and then the adult does not have functional eyes and is albino, essentially, or almost albino. So kind of bizarre. And then where we're at, we have two species in our area, the Tennessee cave salamander, the Berry cave salamander, and there's another one from an isolated cave in West Virginia, which is the West Virginia spring salamander, which is also troglobitic. So just a couple of token gratuitous shots. So one of the problems with taking photographs underground is you obviously need a good flash. So my little digital camera, not going to produce pictures like this. I borrowed these from a buddy of mine, where you set up multiple flashes and you get these nice, grandiose images. This is actually from Stone Cove Cave. It's the type locality of the Tennessee cave salamander. That's the spring entrance there. And this is basically what the typical spring looks like. So most salamanders that you find are going to be out in the open or any rocks. You just kind of walk along the bank, shine your headlamp in there, and it's like, oh, there's a salamander. There's a salamander. It's one of the few caves where it's really, really high density, so they're pretty easy to find. Other caves, though, that we've been in is the exact opposite of this, where we're basically wearing wetsuits, pushing, having to take off our helmet to push passages, had to swim underground. So Tennessee cave salamander lives in a whole host of different habitats. But this kind of makes it seem like, oh, it's nice and easy. Most caves are like that, but there are some that are rather nasty that I don't like to go into. All right, so now to get to the salamander itself. Again, it's going to be an aquatic troglobite, endemic to this area, from the interior low plateau and the Valley and Ridge. Before we started our project, and even now, we still know very little about the life history and ecology of the complex. We know a little bit more now, but eggs have still never been found. We're still hoping that one day we might flip a rock and then find some, but it just hasn't happened. We found gravid females in several caves. We kind of know when they're breeding. Usually they would have already laid by now, so they kind of probably oviposit late winter, maybe December, January. We found hatchlings in spring, but still have just not found, you know, a female on eggs. We found several other species of salamander in caves on eggs, but not the one we're after. So you guys probably should know this by now, the general salamander life cycle. Essentially, in Pelucas and Tennessee cave salamander, we're eliminating that terrestrial adult stage. So they're basically developing into a sexually mature adult as a larva form. All right, so now some pretty pictures, kind of get you caught up to date on the taxonomy. This is the pale salamander. This is actually the Tennessee cave salamander as it was originally described. This individual is actually from Sinking Cove Cave. Again, it's going to be very pale in appearance, very small eyes, and you see large gills and the tail fin. One thing I will point out field guides that the gills are red. That's simply a byproduct of handling, so keep them in a bag, or if you're going to, you know, set up an aquarium and you're kind of handling them, and of course the stress being captured, then take the photo, they're going to be red. When you first capture them, they're clear. So don't use that as a diagnostic character. If you catch a salamander that doesn't have red gills, that doesn't mean it's not a Tennessee cave salamander. All right, the Big Mouth Cave salamander, obviously found at Big Mouth Cave. Originally it was only known from a single locality, but we've kind of expanded that to several more right around that area. But you can see how it differs by having a much darker pigmentation, including some intense spotting in several populations. Again, those eyes can be really, really small. Going to have that well-developed tail fin. Most are going to be about this length. Big adults are about like that. We find a whole size range. You can find juveniles alongside adults. One we have around here, and actually just south of campus, within a mile, is the Berry cave salamander. It's a Gerinophilus guluineatus. It was originally described as a subspecies, and then in the early 90s, kind of elevated to species status because of its disjunct distribution. Again, it has a typical cave salamander form, I like to think. Very small eyes, again, large tail. That's how much kind of longer the limbs look. They're real stocky, and also what's characteristic of a lot of the Berry cave salamander populations is a big bulbous head, which kind of differs from the other populations. And as a specific epithet implies, guluineatus refers to this little stripe on the gular surface. Turns out, not all individuals, even within Berry Cave, have that stripe. Juveniles will not. It kind of develops later on. Populations here in Middle Tennessee, or not Middle Tennessee, but here in Knox County, don't have it, at least the adults that I've captured. More interesting, though, is I've caught spring salamanders up in Great Smoky Mountains National Park that have that stripe, too. So it's kind of a unfortunate naming, but there it is. Its sister species, then, and what we believe Tennessee Cave Salamander Complex evolved from is going to be the spring salamander. Have you guys been on any field trips yet where you found these? They're notoriously hard to find, adults, at least on the surface, except for in a few areas. They're kind of reclusive in nature, and probably because they spend a lot of time underground. But obviously, it's a wide-ranging species. It ranges all the way up into New England, down into Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. The larvae, they're going to resemble the Tennessee Cave salamanders in appearance, but they differ in basically eye size. The eyes in the spring salamander is going to be much larger and pupillated. They've developed iris, and also in the shape of the snout. So just some token photos. Here you can see the larvae, which you can notice right away, even from this kind of crappy photo, how much larger that eye is compared, and particularly like the eye up here. And again, unlike Tennessee Cave salamander, spring salamanders always go through metamorphosis. So far to date, no populations have been found that are basically pedomorphic spring salamanders. I suspect we will find those at some point, kind of like basically a intermediate form between a trogophilic and a trogobitic species. So these are the pretty guys up in the mountains in Daniel's Eye, basically the Blue Ridge Spring salamander. So we basically have two subspecies in Tennessee that's still being worked out. But obviously you can see there's quite a bit of color variation between the last slide versus this slide. And what's interesting about Daniel's Eye populations, at least in the Smoky Mountains, is that the eye size is much smaller than some other populations in the state. But again, you can kind of tell, even by the shape of that snout, that it's different. Now, I will say, Plethodontid salamanders, and you guys probably know this, are notoriously difficult to identify, larval salamanders. It's more of a gestalt with me now, where I can just look at them and say, okay, that looks like Pseudotrite, that looks like Geranopholis, that looks like Eurasia. Eurasia are really, really tough to key out, you know, basically to look at. You really have to key them out, and even then, it's kind of questionable. But Geranopholis, for the most part, I can say I've got down to a science. All right, so quick quiz then. You guys will be tested on this later. Which one's the Tennessee Cave salamander? Which one's the spring salamander? What's the one on the left? That's the cave salamander. Good. You guys at least learned something. You can now identify, distinguish between the two. Now, that being said, there are some populations where we honestly don't know what to call them. One is the devil from Stone Cave. So back in, I think, 97, the Tennessee Aquarium, they have that research institute there. They did a survey around the Chattanooga area looking for Tennessee Cave salamanders, and they found a population outside this small spring, basically in the middle of the Sequatchie Valley, about a half mile off the river, and concluded it was the Tennessee Cave salamander. They found them at night outside the cave within the pool. So we first saw their images and saw the eyes and said, oh, there's no way. Those eyes are way too large. So we went there, we caught this individual. I'm only showing you one half, basically one side. So messed up. He's got one side that has a hook in his eye, and the other side actually is a Pelucas-looking eye, or Tennessee Cave salamander-looking eye. Even more confusing, when we ran the genetics on him, he's got Berry Cave salamander, has a nuclear DNA, he's got spring salamander, spring salamander mitochondrial DNA, and then morphologically, he's kind of like in between. So really kind of bizarre. Then down in Georgia, this is one of the two sites in Georgia you can find him. This is from Frick's Cave on Lookout Mountain. Just from what the images that I've shown you, what subspecies or member of the Tennessee Cave salamander complex would you say that belong to? Would you say Berry Cave salamander, Big Mouth Cave salamander, or Pale salamander? I would say Berry Cave as well, because you look how big that head is. That was my thoughts. But again, it's mixed up genetically. And one of the problems that we have is there's very few sites for the Berry Cave salamander. Most of them are located right up here. And there's only a few scattered caves that are found basically between Knoxville and Chattanooga within the Valley and Ridge. They're usually really small, kind of nasty and muddy. When the Berry Cave salamander was originally described, and within the type series, there was three specimens from a roadside ditch, basically after big heavy spring rain that were flooded at the surface, that were included in there. There's no known caves within 5 miles of that area. So they were coming from somewhere which we have absolutely no access to whatsoever. So I think they're much more widespread than kind of what's currently thought. But, you know, potentially the Berry Cave salamander might maybe extend down into Georgia. Genetically, I only have one individual. I only caught one, so my sample size is pretty limited to say anything about that. But again, it was mixed up. It actually had porphyriticus mitochondrial DNA. So what first got me interested in Geranopholis was the first one I ever caught was in Coffee County on the surface. And I'll show you some range maps here in a minute. But where it was at, there was no known records of spring salamanders. It was basically about 40 miles from the nearest record that I could find. So we originally thought it was Tennessee Cave salamander. We sent it off to the expert at the time, Addison Wynn at the Smithsonian, and he's like, oh, it's got to be a spring salamander because those eyes are large, right? Well, make a long story short, when I finally looked at the genetics of this specimen, it's like pure Nectaroides. Found it at the surface and looked like it was undergoing metamorphosis. So I think occasionally you might have some individuals that do get washed out of caves, and the stress of that because they can't make their way back underground causes them to start to undergo metamorphosis. All right, so this is kind of the general process of kind of how we search for the salamanders. Usually we're on our hands and knees wearing wetsuits. Those of you who don't know, that's actually Dr. Brian Miller and his derriere and his son there in the passage. That's actually a gunner's cave. But essentially we're, you know, flipping rocks, doing everything we can to try to locate these guys, doing our best to try to capture them. Some caves it's very, very easy, where we have almost 100% capture efficiency. Others where we're down below 40 just because of complexity. And after we catch them, of course, we're going to get our basic, you know, life history data, snout vent length, total length, weight. Check the condition, make sure there's not any parasites, see if there's any tail damage, whether they've lost any limbs, basically whether they look healthy, things like that, whether they might be a gravid female. One thing I will mention is they're not sexually dimorphic, so you can't distinguish males from females without actually basically getting out the stereoscope and examining the cloaca. There's subtle differences there. The way that we can kind of tell if it's a female is if it's getting close to breeding season, we look for the eggs visible through the venter. A few caves, roughly I think 10, where we've got ongoing marker capture studies, we've injected these alphanumeric tags. They're basically 1 millimeter by 2 millimeter. Obviously you can see that one's V20. We inject that at the base of the tail. What we found is, and basically the Tennessee Cave salamanders, where that epithelium, you know, is still really thin, those tags hold real well. The spring salamanders, transformed adults, we lose tags like crazy. So working on an experiment right now to determine what kind of longevity we have. But I will mention, at least in some caves, like Big Mouth Cave, we've recaptured individuals that we first tagged 3 years ago. So they're at least holding that long. All right, so real quickly, the distribution then. So this is basically Tennessee. We're up there by the cluster of dots in Knox County. We see Guilineate. It's basically confined to the Valley and Ridge. Then everything else is going to be found on the other side of the Cumberland Plateau. So basically, this right here kind of demarks that border. And most caves that contain Tennessee Cave salamander is going to be found right on or at the base of that escarpment. So right at the base, that's where the water table is at right now. And most of your streams are found. You can also get them scattered throughout the central basin. The most populations there are usually quite low. Routinely, we might go into a cave, catch three, go there 4 more times, not catch any. It's kind of that sporadic. But there are a certain few caves, particularly around here and here, those concentration of caves where we can routinely go in there and catch upwards of 30 and 40 salamanders in a single trip, which is pretty good. So, kind of what I just said, just talking about abundance. So in the 1980s, Addison Wynn, when he came over here to do some alazine work and collect some tissue, he kind of reported number of salamanders that he saw. This is over full trip, so we don't really know. It's kind of, you know, what he's told us through email. 1991, Will and Copeland at a Lincoln Memorial. They were funded by TWRA to do basically the same study that we did. And you can look at their basically abundance data and conclude for yourself. We're not exactly sure what they were doing. We have the impression that they were just going in with flashlights, looking in the pools, so they didn't see anything out right away, concluding that they were in trouble. I don't know. I find it a little bit sketchy, but we can talk more about that over a beer. Then our study, obviously we've got phenomenal numbers, actually very surprising because obviously going in, we didn't think we'd find that many. Certain caves, Cruz Cave, I'll talk about later, we think that's probably a population of spring salamanders. But even like Big Mouth, I've been there 12 times, you routinely always catch between 20 and 30 each trip. The few visits were at Cave Cove, Sinking Cove, Custard Hollow, which are basically the biggest populations within within Tennessee. Again, 30 to 40 individuals. The problem there is it's on a hunting preserve, so half of the year it's closed off for cavers to get in there. A little bit on size frequency. So for the most part, this is for both Pelucus pelugus and Pelucus nectaroides, so Big Mouth Cave Salamander and Tail Salamander. We almost see like a bimodal distribution. That doesn't imply there's only two size classes and two age classes there. We found that basically our sampling technique anyway, we really have trouble capturing a lot of the juveniles. that being said, it's notoriously difficult because they're so small, and depending on, we try to go into these caves and survey when the water conditions are, you know, been stable, hadn't been any rain within the last 4 or 5 days, water should be clear, no turbidity. Even then, it's still very tough. So if you get a very complex habitat where there's a lot of detritus mats, I mean, you can find little salamanders with their heads sticking out, these little detritus mats. Some caves are going to have tons upon tons of rocks, so you can't flip every one. Others, very few, so it's pretty obvious where they're at. But in certain caves, particularly like Cave Cove Cave, where I'll show you the histogram here a little bit, it's essentially almost all adults that we're catching. We're not catching any juveniles whatsoever. But you go downstream in that system, and you're catching primarily juveniles or subadults, so not mature individuals. So there's a lot of variation in there, and exactly what that means from a biological standpoint, we don't know. Yeah?
What cave was that you said?
Cave Cove, not Cades Cove. Yeah, Cave Cove is in southern Franklin County, down just south of Suwannee, if you know where that's at. So this kind of illustrates what I just talked about. Essentially, we're catching mostly adult individuals because obviously they're also going to be the most visible and easiest to see. Ideally, we like to search real shallow water, maybe no deeper than 20 centimeters or so, but we found them in, you know, in pools as deep as 10 feet where I just don't feel like I want to wear snorkel gear to go down and try to catch them. I'll just say I saw one. But yeah, there's no telling how deep they might actually get. So there's well records of like the Texas Eurasia, where they've been down as deep as 300 to 400 feet below the surface. There's actually a new species being described. I think it's known from like two specimens that were captured in a well. We don't really see that around here with Geranophilus. There's no records from wells. And because even so, most of the wells are going to be rather shallow on the Cumberland Plateau. So here's what I was talking about. So this is basically Cave Cove, Sinking Cove, and Hollow. They're all within about a mile of each other. But the blue is Cave Cove, where we find the largest individuals, almost no juveniles. We're at Custard Hollow. We find more of a medium distribution. Exactly why that is, we don't know. When you look at it, you know, statistically, you know, based on the average size of any individual, so adults, based on dissections done in the 70s, they found any male or female over 70 millimeters in stout bent length was considered sexually mature. So looking at those size classes, you know, they're all statistically different between caves. biologically, what does that mean? These two are actually hydrologically connected, with Cave Cove being upstream. So one possibility is that the majority of the population is within Cave Cove, and then it's kind of downstream dispersal of the young, and whether they can actually, adults migrate them back up, we don't know. We've got it in both. So maybe in 10 years from now, we might find individuals that we marked in Sinking Cove Cave, actually within Cave Cove Cave. That would be pretty neat to see, whether there's that kind of migration, because they're about a mile apart. And that being said, Sinking Cove, I'll just mention, is about 26,000 feet long surveyed passage, and so we can't actually survey it in one day. Usually it takes us two or three to really search it effectively. Cave Cove is also over a mile long, so these caves where we find large numbers of salamanders are also very, very long passages and very large conduits. Talk a little bit about population size, where we've got really good marker capture data. A big cave. This is the first six trips. We're up to 12 now. But essentially, we've got a stable estimate, depending on you want to assume an open or closed population, anywhere between 100 and 150 individuals. We've got about 70 marked. Those tags work well in anything basically over 40 millimeters in snout vent length. Anything smaller than that, we're real likely to either hurt the animal and cause it to drop its tail, so we don't even bother with the juveniles. So this is basically an estimate of individuals over 40 millimeters in snout vent length. Just doing Lincoln-Peterson estimates for like Custard Hollow Cave and Sinking Cove Cave, where we just have two trips, we get estimates upwards between 600 and 1,000 individuals within those caves. So they can be quite dense. We've got some limited growth data then from some of the big mouth animals where we've captured multiple times, and we found that they grow much more rapidly than we thought, upwards of maybe even a centimeter to a centimeter and a half in a single year. So kind of the ongoing belief is that the cave environment is going to be kind of a paucity of food, so most organisms are going to grow very, very slowly. Big mouth is one of these systems where it gets just a ton of organic input. Not only organic input, but trash. So, you know, farmers or any of your local hillbillies who like to throw their mattresses and old trash within a sinkhole, well, guess where it goes? You know, it goes down in these systems, and then guess where they get their water from? Well, the spring down below where they're dumping the trash in. So some folks haven't figured that out yet. But within systems like that, where you can find lots of debris, you've got large amounts of organic matter, so there's just tons of isopods and amphipods, the primary food source. You can find earthworms that get washed in that they're eating. Other salamanders, each other. So they also eat cavefish, crayfish, things like that. So they can grow quite rapidly. So when you figure that, the average adult is roughly around 90 millimeters snout vent length, and they grow, let's say, a centimeter a year. Okay, they're going to hatch out at about 10 to 15 millimeters. So even just to reach that size, you're talking 9, 10 years old just there. And obviously, as you're reaching sexual maturity, your growth is going to be stunted, so your growth rate's going to decrease. We've captured, the largest one we've ever caught is 117 millimeter snout vent length. The largest on record is 134. So there's no telling exactly how old that individual might be. I'm guessing, you know, probably as old as me. I'm 27. So maybe even older. We just don't know. Another thing I'll quickly point out, this kind of has implications down in Alabama, where you kind of find populations that are kind of intermediate between the spotted form and that pale form. Partially due, I think, to the fact that there's an oncogenic shift, or basically change in coloration within the spotted form as they mature. So both these individuals are about the same size, but from two different caves. This is the spotted form, this is the pale form. But you'll notice at this size, they're nearly indistinguishable. So I think what's going on in Alabama is, you know, partially there might be some historic contact, genetic contact between them, but a lot of the records where they talk about pale form or spotted form within the same cave is an artifact of this, where you've got spotted individuals basically do not develop that pigmentation until they're around 50 millimeters or so, it's not vent length. All right, some other cool things that we found. You can notice in this photo that this individual is missing a limb. Its back limb is completely gone. This was actually from Berry Cave in Roane County. In Big Mouth Cave, we find salamanders there that are missing tails all the time, or you can see noticeable regrowth, missing limbs, missing half, basically one side of a gill arch. You know. In those systems, there's usually a lot of crayfish, other salamanders, cavefish also kind of tussle with these guys, but particularly the primary predator is going to be crayfish, and we've actively witnessed crayfish going underneath rocks searching for salamanders, capturing a couple on occasion. And it's, you know, its first instinct, since it has the ability to regenerate that limb, just do the alligator death roll, pop it off, and escape so it can survive. So there's our little notorious. So that's a small one, but large tenebrosis crayfish, they can get upwards of like this long in a cave, and so they're a pretty formidable opponent. In some cave systems, like Big Mouth as well, you might find this underground. This is about a 15-pound channel cat that we caught, and is obviously looking pretty fat. Now, whether it's feeding within the cave environment, we don't know yet. We checked the stomach contents, and it was empty, and released it. But you can notoriously find large fish. You can find lipomas, blue bass, suckers, things like that. But then probably I would say the most adapted would be this catfish. One this size, I mean, it can take out anything. Yeah?
Did you do any analysis of like stomach?
Yeah. Check the stomach contents of this one. It didn't have anything. But we just don't know whether they're actively, you know, feeding. But what's odd is some of these fish, I mean, so the spring outlet to Big Mouth Cave, where you actually intercept the main stream passage there, is about a mile and a quarter downstream. So some of these fish are swimming all the way up, at least that far, and hanging out. We've seen this individual there on three different occasions, so it's been there for at least 8 months. And you can see it's looking pretty fat, so I'm thinking it's picking off crayfish and potentially even salamanders. All right, so briefly I'll talk about the genetics. It's kind of thought that the Tennessee Cave Salamander complex arose from the spring salamander during the Pleistocene, those glaciation cycles. As the hypothesis goes, essentially the interglacial periods warmed up. Since spring salamanders are basically cold weather or cold water adapted, they either migrated to the uplands, essentially in the Upper Cumberland Plateau, or they took refuge underground in springs and caves. Over time then, those populations that invaded caves became isolated and then started to develop this cave-associated morphologies, reduction in eyes, to the point where they became completely troglobitic. So being kind of as that hypothesis states, this occurred during the Pleistocene. We'd predict it's a relatively young group genetically, so maybe within the last 1 to 3 million years, as opposed to the Texas Eurasia, which appear to be much older, upwards maybe 15 to 20 million years old. And just kind of a close-up distribution. One thing you'll notice is that the Tennessee Cave Salamander Complex, here to A and B, basically this is the spotted form. This is primarily the pale form with some spotted individuals out there. You find that basically at the western periphery of the range of the spring salamander. The exception to that is Guillaumeatus, the Berry Cave salamander, which overlaps, but there's only been two recorded instances where spring salamanders and Tennessee Cave salamanders have been found together within the same cave. One is here in Knox County at Mead Quarry Cave, and the other is down in Alabama. One at Mead Quarry, they appear to be hybridizing. I'll kind of show you some images and talk about that here in a little bit. All right, so quickly the genetics. Make a long story short, the Tennessee Cave Salamander complex forms primarily a monophyletic group, which is kind of what we like, except there are some misplaced individuals. First example, so purple here is the Berry Cave Salamander. You'll notice it's B1 over in the blue, which is with the Tennessee Cave Salamander. That's actually the type locality, Berry Cave. All individuals that I sampled from there fell out where they shouldn't have. also the type locality for the Big Mouth Cave Salamander, this BM1, actually moved in with spring salamanders from the eastern Highland Rim of Cumberland Plateau. And then the Frick's Cave individual that I showed you, it actually had spring salamander mitochondrial DNA, which is quite divergent. What this basically says, you might, depending on what you want to call a species, they're a relatively young group. So basically a process known as ancestral lineage sorting, where haplotypes, or basically genetic sequences within the ancestral stock, have been scattered just by chance, random chance, throughout those groups. If you look at the distribution then, again, you can kind of see where they primarily fall out. What we did notice, though, is that there wasn't any difference at all genetically between Nectaroides and Pelucus, or the big mouth cave salamander and the cave salamander. A paper that we're getting ready to submit to molecular ecology, we're not going to recommend any elevation or sinking of the taxonomy. Now, the one nuclear gene that we looked at, RAG1, put it in perspective, this is one base pair change. There's virtually no genetic differentiation between the two. We kind of see some consistencies where basically all Berry Cave individuals, Berry Cave salamander individuals, had that haplotype. But, you know, statistically, if you do bootstrap support, other statistical methods, there's no statistical support for this tree, other than Geranopholis forms a monophyletic group. In contrast to the two outgroups I used, the many-lined salamander and the red salamander. Again, if you look at the distribution, this kind of falls out more in line with traditional morphology and taxonomy. Just keep in mind that there's very little genetic differentiation between the groups. One area that is kind of interesting, though, is down here in Marion County, where after I did my master's, collected this individual. So essentially anything on the eastern escarpment of the Cumberland Plateau is typically pale, at least within that area, except for this population. It's about, you kind of see that red dot within the green blob there, next to that green dot. They're separated by about a quarter mile within the same hydrological connection. One cave has a spotted individual, the other has a pale individual, or pale population, kind of odd. And then 2 years ago, Floyd Scott up at Austin Peay, they collected a spring salamander basically about a mile and a half from those localities, slightly about 300 feet in elevation above those caves. So there appears to be a contact zone there. It might be some interesting things going on. The problem is most of those caves have very small populations, so it's tough to get any kind of sample size to work with. Briefly, just kind of shows divergence between the major clades that we found, and just applying a basic molecular clock, how long they may have been separated. So between like Pelucus and Gulineatus, maybe up to 800,000 years. Between some groups, the Porphyriticus and Pelucus, maybe between 2 and 10 million years, depending on the clock you want to use. But still relatively recently. Put that in perspective, Ken Kozak came out with a paper 2 years ago looking at the two-line salamander complex and found substantially more genetic variation over the same geographic area that I sampled, with divergence estimates dating back even 20 million years between some groups. Alright, so some of the funny business then. Crease Cave, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is basically found about a mile from where we are. It has one of the largest populations of Geranopholis that I know of. Our record there is we caught 84 individuals. So you would think it's probably a pretty long passage. It's really not. It's only about 700 feet long, and most of the stream is rather small, but it just gets a lot of organic matter that gets washed in. You just have these large leaf buildups along the margins where earthworms are at, and so you'll see transformed Geranopholis like this, basically sitting in those leaf mats, looking around for earthworms, things like that. But there's a lot of variation phenotypically. You can have individuals ranging from this kind of orangish appearance to a more Gulineatus looking appearance. Some have like a chin spot, some might have a stripe, some have nothing. Some have small eyes, some have large eyes. It's really kind of a mixed bag. Genetically, though, the 11 samples that I included with my master's work were all identical, and they were all Porphyriticus. So they're all spring salamanders. What we've done since then is we've gone back in and I've collected about 110 different tissue samples. So that's what I've been working on this spring. So maybe if I give a talk here in a couple of years or something, I got something really cool to say. Hopefully they're not all the same thing. It'd be really neat if there's some interbreeding going on. This individual I actually caught 2 years ago and sent it off to the lab because it has those open red sores. Had as a trematode infection. Certain populations are more susceptible than others. Cave-dwelling trematode around this area where we noticed at a Berry Cave, also here at Cruz Cave, and a couple populations down in Georgia where it's just very, very prevalent. So usually it's like every individual in the cave has it or none of them have it. In this case, this individual looked like it succumbed to the infection. I'd have to look it up. I can tell. It might be. I don't know. I'll forward you the email. So yeah, we sent it off to a group down at Auburn. Mead Quarry Cave then. So if you've been out to Iams, you know the Mead Quarry site. Just off the railroad tracks there is where another Gulliniatus site is located. Again, in this cave, you can find small-eyed individuals to almost large eyes. But these individuals here, you might look at them, they're metamorphosed, but notice how their eyes aren't completely developed at all, as opposed to those individuals in Cruz Cave, which you'd think would be a spring salamander. These genetically, and these appear to be F1 or F2 hybrids. So really kind of neat. Problem is we haven't caught what we'd call a full-fledged spring salamander, you know, morphologically from that cave. Anyone ever wants to go to Mead Quarry Cave, I'm always looking for help around here, usually. I'll take you in and we'll see what happens. Usually what happens is I get people on one or two trips, I take them to an easy cave first and then I kind of work their way up and then take them to a rough cave and then I never see them again. So, start you out rough? Okay. Yeah, we'll do that. So Mead Quarry, it's a mud pit. You'll get mud in places you know you didn't even know you had. But it really kind of interesting. Just the morphological variation within that cave. So kind of put in perspective where that's located in relation to Cruz Cave. So you see the river, Cambus is basically right up there. Here's Cruz Cave down here. And then Mead Quarry, there's a cluster of caves all hydrologically connected. Essentially, when they did the quarry operations, they found the caves and then tried to fill them back in without success. But you can see how close suburban fill is in relation to those cave sites. So there's actually a meeting tonight that I obviously can't go to because I'm here right now, where they're still talking about the James White Parkway extension, which would kind of run basically through this general area and cross the hydrologic boundary. Obviously, a lot of folks are in opposition to that, and one of the ways that they've tried to throw it off, the development of that road in the past, is with the Berry Cave Salamander. So I'll have something to say about that maybe next time, see what comes up about it. So 640, this is kind of the second half here, so it might be a good time for a break, or if there's any questions you have on the first half. Yeah. So for the most part, caves that have large populations, they're getting a lot of organic input, but it's pretty good water quality. Around here, the caves are in the 10 Mile Creek system, so out in West Knoxville. So the 10 Mile Creek essentially drains all all the commercial areas, all those parking lots, all that gas gets thrown in. We're still finding juveniles, first, second year individuals, so reproduction is still occurring, but you know, what kind of impact that's having, we don't know quite yet. Even around here, I mean, you find lots of trash, but they tend to hold their own. They're pretty hardy. It's kind of a mixed bag. There's some cave systems in southern middle Tennessee which have been basically exposed to water treatment, runoff, sewage runoff, others to diesel spills. But they tend to bounce back. They're pretty hardy, but we really don't know the long-term outcome or what, you know, the populations were like 30 years ago, 100 years ago. You know, that data is just, it's just not there. Yeah, particularly around, it's notoriously difficult to try to get a population estimate for these cave organisms because you just can't sample all their habitat. What's kind of interesting is there's particularly the caves in the central basin. I mean, you might be in the major channel, right? And so you're able to walk around. But then if you sink down, you know, crouch down and look, you can see passage that might be this high. Obviously, you're not getting in there. And particularly me, I'm a big guy, so there's a lot of passages I can't go in. But it just goes back as far as you can see. So it's, you know, essentially a honeycomb effect. So there's no telling, you know, how expansive a lot of these cave systems are. We just don't know.
Is the complex, is that listed at the state level?
So at the state level, they are listed. They delineate us as a distinct taxonomic family. Side salamander, 5 minute breeding site. Development side salamander. It's a type. It's related to smallmouth. But yeah, they would be much more in trouble than in the subterranean species that we have. Yeah, that sounds good. Whatever you guys normally do. There we go. So while we've been kind of doing the Gerinophilus survey, we've also been keeping tallies of every other herp that we found, actually every other vertebrate outside bats. And we stopped counting bats a long time ago. Now there's lots of bats in here. There's a few. So we've kept track of numbers of every amphibian and reptile that we found. So to date, and these are accurate, I've personally been in 122 caves in the last 3 years, which accounts for about 213 surveys. We found 14 different species of salamander, 10 different species of frog, and even 3 snakes, 1 lizard, and 1 turtle. Obviously, you can see the majority of our records are for salamanders, with frogs a distant second there. I don't know how well that displays, but each of those white dots kind of gives you an idea of where we sampled at. Yeah?
What were the snake species?
I'll show them here in a minute. You're jumping ahead of me. Yeah, just settle. I'll get there. Okay. So most of our concentration, again, is going to be around those caves on the escarpments of the plateau because, you know, our ulterior motive, really the main reason we're in there is to look for Pelucas. So we kind of have a sampling bias.
But
So I'm actually a member of the Tennessee Cave Survey. It's an organization that actually probably one of the best in the nation at keeping track. It's like a cave database, cave society. There's almost 10,000 caves within Tennessee. We have the most caves of any other state in the nation. So to qualify as a cave, it has to be at least be 50 feet in length, at least be 30 feet deep if it's a pit. And then if it's like in between, then it's like some other little ratio that I can't remember. But yeah, so lots and lots of caves, and I've got narratives. What's nice about the Tennessee Cave Survey is they have narrative files with locations, descriptions of the entrance, description of the passage for most of these caves. Alabama has a cave survey, but all they have is coordinates for the cave locations. And it's kind of an interesting group because obviously all walks of life are members of this group. So you have some folks who are really paranoid about people finding their caves, so they'll actually intentionally report coordinates that aren't accurate. They might be off by a degree, but they know that, or they're off by a second or a couple seconds. So they have this system worked out between some little clicks. That's what we found. So it's kind of bizarre. People prize their caves. Obviously, I'm going into it for the wildlife and the biology. Others go into it because they look at cool formations or just to see how many caves they've been in. So everyone's got their reasons. All right, so here's kind of a quick breakdown of our amphibian records. Obviously, Gerinophilus, predominates. A lot of that is what we're focusing on, but the most abundant salamander we found is Eurystia lucifica, the cave salamander. We found them just about everywhere. It's very rare not to find them in a cave. Other species of Eurystia, like long-tailed salamanders, two-line salamanders, red salamanders, those abbreviations that I have, like TB, TP, that kind of stands for their classification, whether it's a troglobite, so TB, troglophile is TP, TX is going to be that troglozine, and AC, accidental. Some other species then, like zigzag salamanders, pigeon mountain salamanders, slimy salamanders. The recently described Cumberland mountain dusky salamander, spotted duskies, even four toads. We found one individual in a pit, even newts. Frog-wise, the most abundant is going to be pickerel frogs. You know, kind of makes sense. Usually find them in more cool water stream settings, followed by green frogs and then bullfrogs. And then most everything after that is just kind of accidental records that we've encountered. So there's actually about five caves where we can routinely get over five species of amphibian in that cave each trip. One of those is one I'm going to talk a lot about is Gunner's Cave, where we routinely always find longtails, cave salamanders, red salamanders, zigzags in the entrance, occasionally find a spring salamander in there, and then always find pickerel frogs and green frogs in there. A couple other caves up in Pickett County are the same way, which is very, very, they're just very speciose for whatever reason. You know, we've been trying to analyze, we don't really have enough data yet. Eventually, you know, after I sample like 300 caves and have a real big data set, I can maybe start to tease out patterns with their distribution and why maybe some caves are more speciose than others. I also try to get in what I'm slowly doing. I mentioned the Tennessee Cave Survey. The problem with their database is it's very, very old and it's in a paper form. It's like a Word file. So I'm like slowly converting all their records over to a database so that I can do some data analysis. And since there's almost 10,000 records, I'm a bit behind. So I've got a lot more to do. So hopefully, maybe the next 10 years, I'll have a paper on something like that. But it's kind of a non-pressing matter. Reptile-wise, we've got three species of snake. So we found a timber rattlesnake inside a cave mouth. Kind of not surprising in that usually in the hot summer months, you're going to find a lot of snakes and other even mammals seeking refuge around caves because they're going to be much cooler. It's nature's air conditioning. So I think it was two summers ago, it was about 102 degrees. It was like one of our extreme heat waves, and there was a rattlesnake there right at the entrance. Rat snakes are, we've got three records, but there's been reports in literature for years and years where they'll actually reside, particularly at bat caves, where they'll reside in the twilight zone or at the entrance waiting for the bats to fly out and trying to pick them off as they fly out. One record of a water snake, we found that individual about 2,000 feet in from a spring cave. He apparently just had wandered in, and he was pretty thin when we got him, so we took him back out. Ground skink, that's kind of a bizarre one too, just about 300 feet in, and he was just back there, kind of looked like he wandered in. Box turtles, three different caves we found box turtles in, two were adults, one was actually a hatchling. The hatchling that we found was actually a big mouth cave, and it was found in March right after a big rain and wasn't in good shape. Basically had been flooded in, washed out, was still actually partially within the egg sitting in there. Unfortunately, it died. It's now in the collection in MTSU. So we've talked a lot about the Tennessee Cave Salamander. I'll just talk a little bit about Spring Salamander. We've got roughly about 438 different records. Most of those are from Cruz Cave. It just has such a massive population in there. Both these images are from Cruz. So you can get large transformed individual and also a very large larva form individual. One thing I didn't show, the histogram there, basically between larva form and then transformed, there's a distinct cutoff at about 95 millimeters snout vent length. Almost all individuals are going to be transformed. Below that, they're almost always larva form. So they're actually metamorphosing at a very, very large size within that cave. Again, we haven't found any eggs. We have found hatchlings at Crew's Cave. I mentioned earlier the cannibalism and also the trematode parasites. We've found evidence of those in several caves. But surprisingly, of the 127 caves we've been in, usually spring salamanders and the cave salamanders are considered the most trigophilic species. We've only found them in 14 caves, usually in pretty good densities there, but actually not that many caves. Two-line salamanders, okay, Eurystheus erydra. We've got 66 different observations from 8 caves. Found adults, larvae, and eggs, so it's kind of neat about the eggs. I'll show some pictures of that here. We have a cave, this Gunner's Cave in Cannon County, where usually about January and February and into early March, we found 2 years ago 6 different females on eggs underneath rocks within the aphotic zone, or within the dark zone within the cave. When we first find them, of course, we're super excited. We've routinely been there throughout the month. We find that the males move in usually around October to November, hang out at the twilight zone just inside the entrance. I guess wait for the females, kind of intercept them to breed. The females then migrate back into the cave up to as much as 300 feet to oviposit, you know, stay with their nest. Once they hatch out, then the females migrate back out. So it's a really kind of a wild system. It's the first known observation of two-line salamanders breeding in caves. Really just kind of bizarre. So kind of give you an idea. This is the same clutch that we photographed 3 different occasions, so you kind of get a hint of development there, and actually a hatchling found right around the area where that clutch was found. So this we found usually takes about between 7 to 13 weeks to develop and hatch. And some other data there, just kind of showing you. So our first visit in this case, this is from 2 years ago. We've got more recent data, but you can find them upwards of 300 feet into the cave. They're actually migrating quite a ways up that cave stream to oviposit. Long-tailed salamanders, also fairly abundant, but only got them from 15 caves, and it's really kind of sporadic where we found them at. Mostly found just adults and a few larvae. But another interesting observation that we did make, though, and we're writing up for a little herp review note, is at Gunner's Cave, we observed a partial courtship sequence where we had a male trailing a female through this riparian breakdown zone at the base of a waterfall for upwards of 5 minutes. It was kind of interesting watching the female. The female, I don't think, was interested whatsoever. She was just trying to get away, and he was just following her heels the entire time. All right, the cave salamander. So when I give talks to the general public, this is what everyone thinks a Tennessee cave salamander is, the orange guys with the black spots, and they're always like, well, I see them everywhere, you know. But now, obviously it gets its name because it is found in caves quite a bit. You can find them on the surface as well, particularly this time of year if it was wetter out. Middle Tennessee, they'll be out in the glades quite a bit. But out of the 127 caves we visited, we find them in 89, so obviously a high percentage. Upwards is the most we've ever seen in one congregation. We found 99 within about an area on a cave wall the size of this room. Not exactly sure why. It was in February. There was just kind of this large aggregation. Not exactly sure what was going on there. We found, of course, juveniles and larvae, kind of a larva getting ready to metamorphose there at the bottom. And also eggs we found. Actually, Mead Quarry Cave on Halloween 3 years ago, we found a female ovipositing within a water-filled depression caused by an old footprint, since it's basically mud banks. And we found that Lucifica tends to scatter their eggs through isolated pools. They're not going to lay in the main stream channel. They're going to lay in these usually elevated, maybe flooded depressions or water or depressions that are filled by like drip pools, things like that, and they just kind of scatter them around all over the place. We also found this guy, this male from a cave in Smith County, which had this flatworm infestation. We've sent that off, and turns out it's a new species of flatworm related to a group that attacks, or basically infects, fishes, particularly lipomas and perches. But obviously, it's kind of residing. Really, it's kind of creepy when you look at it, because this thing would move around like crazy in there, and it still kind of creeps me out. I'm not a big worm guy, flatworm leech guy. That's actually the worm, the flatworm. Yeah, so that thing would just migrate and move around, you know, just feeding, so you have that big edema that's swelling around it. But we put the salamander, actually the salamander, I didn't put it down, it succumbed to heat. It was really warm that day and didn't have enough ice in the cooler, so it died, fortunately. But before it died, it was completely healthy, looked healthy otherwise, activity was normal, things like that. Yeah, just another one of these bizarre observations that we've made. Red salamanders, we've got about 225 records from about 25 caves. What's more interesting about these guys is before we started our study, I think there's been 3 recorded instances in the literature of overposition in the field of red salamanders. We actually, in 3 different locations, found females on clutches, one in Georgia and 2 here in Tennessee, with one being Gunner's Cave again. Like, this cave is just the magical cave for natural history of Plethodon salamanders, I think. So we're kind of surprised by that. One of the coolest things that we saw, and some of you who went to the Southeast Park meeting kind of probably saw Brian talk a little bit about this, but we found a female this past, I guess it was October, actually ovipositing while we were there in this rimstone pool, which it's the first time I've ever seen a salamander oviposit, so it's pretty cool. But essentially, I mean, you see the motion that she makes. We watched her for roughly about 30 minutes go through this and lay about 3 eggs while we were there, so maybe about an egg every 10 minutes. Her total clutch that we were able to count was, I think, 63 up to that point. Obviously, she still had eggs. So if she's taking 10 minutes per egg, you know, maybe the, you know, how reliable that data is, but she's, you know, taking a considerable amount of time being in that vulnerable position. Obviously, underground in a cave, she's not going to have that many predators. Maybe a raccoon might wander in. But you can see, you know, the vulnerability. You can translate this to other surface species that are going to be laying in surface streams. But yeah, just kind of bizarre. She'd actually use her tail, you'd think like an alligator would, to kind of brace herself underneath and then get in position. And then she'd go through this series of gyrations before that egg would finally attach. So the year before, actually from a different clutch, we were again able to follow a series of clutches throughout. We noticed, for the most part, like this clutch, I think, had a reduction of about 40% of the eggs from beginning to when we first found them to the end. So actually, I think less than that, or more than that. So I'm trying to remember, maybe 60 or so eggs initially, and from that in the same pool we ended up with, I think, 16 hatchlings. So we were, you know, trying to think about what type of predators might be actively attacking the eggs. One thing that we noticed, you might notice in this top picture up here, you kind of see that white little blob. That's actually a cave planarian. We found them in high densities around basically where the nests were located. We found a total of 8 nests the first year, 7 the next year. They were all located within an area about the size of this table where females were basically what we thought were communally nesting together. Sometimes you'd find 2 females underneath the same rock. But in, around that whole area, you'd find a lot of these cave planarians, upwards of 20 to 30. So I imagine they were picking off a few of the eggs. Then we had this one female here. This female's in the small rimstone pool. She actually stayed there. We actually caught her, or seen her there, 6 months earlier than that same pool, okay? Knew it was her. We had her tagged. Came back, I think back in October, we found the eggs there. Came back again next time we visited. We were down to 3 eggs. You can see the egg stalks there where eggs have been removed, so obviously it looks like something has grabbed a hold of them and ate them. So we thought because she was staying in that pool that entire time, she was probably ingesting her own eggs. We came back this past March, not past March, but that past October, and found another female there the same day that we saw the oviposition. Another female there, she just out of the blue, while we were there, leaves her nest, goes over to this other female's nest, and we watched her eat the egg, eat two eggs before there was a huge fight, and then she got removed. That female then, who invaded, made a V-line. This is a complete darkness outside of our headlamps, right? Made a complete V-line for another nest. That's how we were able to locate another one. Went straight to that one, did the same thing, then went to a third nest before going back to hers, all in about like 15 minutes. Just absolutely bizarre. And so we ended up catching all the females, and then, you know, of course she's the biggest one, so apparently there is some territoriality and potential egg cannibalism within Pseudotriton, which is just completely bizarre. But just while we were there, I'd never seen anything like it. So the males are moving in with the females. So we kind of have a mixed bag here at Gunner's Cave, where it looks like maybe some females are staying there year-round, like the one in this image here, where she's at least out in there 8 months out of the year. There's some that are definitely migrating in and then migrating back out. So the beginning of the breeding season, so like end of July, August, beginning of September, you find the males back in the same area, and then as the season progresses, they're moving out apparently, or going somewhere else in the cave. We don't know, we just don't see them. Pseudotriton also is not sexually dimorphic, so we're just inferring based on size. We find smaller individuals kind of on the periphery of where all these eggs or all these clutches are at, that they're probably the males. They might be immature females, but outside, you know, putting them down and finding out for sure, we don't really want to do that. But yeah, definitely doesn't look like they're sticking around in that area. Zigzag salamanders then, that should not be 851 records, that would be a typo. I think it's roughly around in the 70s. Again, got them from 14 caves. And cool thing, last summer is we found a female in the cave there with a single egg, one lone egg, the first clutch that I've ever seen. And apparently the third that's been recorded. And judging by her size, I don't think she could have produced many more than maybe three eggs, and she was pretty tiny. Interestingly though, in that same area, I don't know if it was just a micro habitat kind of, or microclimate type of situation, there were 30 other subadults, what I would call subadults, that did not appear mature, basically around where her nest was located. So again, kind of bizarre. But again, that's another one of these species that, you know, it looks like they use subterranean realm for reproduction, and probably spend a substantial portion of their year underground, and then when surface conditions are right, they're able to migrate back up. And it's amazing how they're able to detect that. That's something I'd eventually like to work on. If anyone's done any road cruising around Middle Tennessee at all during the summertime, if it's been extremely dry, like it's been now, or like last summer. First big rain that we had, I think this was back in August, I went on out looking for herps just to pass the time. Came up on this hill, and then I started seeing these things moving on the road. And I thought they were earthworms at first, until I finally stopped for a frog, and when I was looking around, it turns out they were zigzag salamanders. On this maybe about 200-yard stretch, I mean, I honestly could have collected, I'm guessing, over 1,000 zigzag salamanders that were just all up. It's like I don't know if it was a mass migration or it was just been so dry that they were just super hungry and finally had a chance to get to the surface. But it's amazing just the densities that you can have in areas that you wouldn't think would be real good for amphibians. Slimy salamanders, also very numerous. Got them in around 30 caves. Fortunately, no reproduction to date. There are several records of slimy salamander nests from caves and also mine shafts. We found upwards of 102 individuals. Usually they're hanging out in the twilight zone. We don't find them too often deep within a cave. They're usually kind of hanging around the twilight zone. And there definitely appears to be a seasonal shift where during the drier months they're moving in, probably because it's cooler and moister, and then moving back out when surface conditions are favorable. One thing I will point out, you might notice the dorsal coloration of this subadult, it's kind of this gold flecking color. How many of you guys have seen Yanalassi salamanders at Pigeon Mountain? So you know how that red pigmentation. I think this is probably an undescribed species. People in the past have sent Dick Hyten, so he's Mr. Plethodontid salamander systematist, specimens from basically the southern sections of the Cumberland Plateau. And of course, when they're ethanol preserved, that color fades away, so they just look like typical slimy salamanders. And he just counted them off, it's just a northern slimy. We've actually collected some tissue samples, and we're working on those right now to see if it is, you know, genetically distinct. But for whatever reason, in an isolated pocket, you find individuals there that have almost like a lichen green color to this gold flecking. And as juveniles and subadults, it's almost completely solid. And as they get larger and become adults, color starts to fade away, but you can still see that gold flecking. So it's kind of interesting. Quickly, a little bit about the frogs. Pickerel frogs, very common. Found them in 34 caves. Of course, they're not going to be breeding in the caves. We have heard males that'll be, you know, within the twilight zone. You can hear them calling on occasion within a cave. Kind of creepy because you're trying to figure, because it kind of reverberates and sounds completely different. You kind of have that echo effect. again, very, very common. Green frogs as well. Again, very common. Some cool things we've seen with those. We have a little Herp Review publication, Brian and I, outside Snail Shell Cave in Rutherford County. We saw this frog kind of tussling in the twilight zone. It was just kind of acting funny. Went over there and looked, and a large crayfish had actually gotten a hold of the frog and had already eaten off most of the left leg. And I think would have consumed the rest had we not collected them both. But apparently that's the first observation of a crayfish ingesting a rannid frog adult. I was surprised by that. I figured it might have been more common, but maybe not.
Maybe not that commonly observed.
Yeah, that could also be the case, but or maybe just people take it for granted like we did and just don't think about it. But that's kind of all I have to kind of show you guys. I guess make it out a little bit early. It's already 7:20. But yeah, anyone who's ever interested in going out, before I started the project, I had no caving experience whatsoever. Now I'm doing vertical stuff, so it's definitely a lot of fun because you never know what you're going to see, not only amphibian-wise or reptile-wise if you're into herps, but, you know, I work with cavefish now, and they're really, really neat. I've collected apparently 3 new species of amphipod that are new to science that I had no. I mean, I recognized it was something that I hadn't seen before and sent them off to the experts, and yeah, apparently it's a new species. Interesting observations that you can make. I mean, if you're into archaeology, I mean, a lot of these caves we go into, you can see evidence of, you know, old Indian habitation, torch marks. You can see different scrapings and cave paintings on occasion, little smudges where they've drawn turkeys and deer and things like that. So it's really a lot of fun. If you're claustrophobic at all, then maybe not. If you're not sure, you can probably find out real fast. I have a funny story with that. We were on Tennessee Wildside. So you guys have probably seen that show. And the host there's a image of him crawling in this cave passage, right, down on all fours. Turns out he's actually crawling out of the cave in this lower stretch, because when he first got in there, and I've seen this only on 3 occasions, and he was one of those, where as soon as he got down to where it started to get low, he immediately freaked out and just like froze in panic. And we actually had to physically drag him out of where he was at so he could finally like get it together, and then was able to crawl out of the cave the rest of the way. But once the ceiling got like too low, he just like completely spazzed. I've been with another TWA agent who was out, or officer who was out with us, and we had a situation where there's a passage that we went in and then it kind of looped back around and then dropped in the same passage. Well, I recognized it right away. It's no big deal. Someone else in our group wasn't so sure, so they kind of questioned that. And as soon as this guy heard that kind of indecision where we were at inside the cave, he immediately freaked out. So it just depends on the situation. Everyone handles it differently. But it's a lot of fun. So if you guys are ever interested, I'm always going out, particularly during the summer months. That's when I do most of my field work. But weekends for sure, and then if I ever have any days during the week, I like to go out. And even not with, cave life, but if you want to go out and go herping, looking for other critters, by all means, let me know. So more the merrier. And if you guys have any questions, be happy to stick around.
Thanks a lot, Matt, for coming on over. Appreciate it.
No problem.